I'm pleased to introduce our next speaker, who's going to be Marta Kuzma, who's director of the Office for Contemporary Art in Norway. She has a Middlesex connection, which is that she's a she was a graduate of our program in MA in Aesthetics and Art Theory some years back at Middlesex in our in the center. I first encountered her personally in the early 90s when she was the director of the Soros Center for Contemporary Art in Kiev and helped set up that institution and ran it in the early years. And what was a very interesting time. She subsequently worked in Washington on the Washington Project for the Arts. She was the co-curator of Manifesto 5, and she also still curates as well as being the director of OCHA. And she's going to talk about the role of sex in representations of Scandinavia in the 60s and 70s.
Thank you, Peter. This presentation is entitled Representations of Sex in Scandinavia in the 1970s, as it was billed in the information packets going out about the seminar. But it should more accurately read as Representations of Sex in Scandinavia in the 1960s and 1970s. This initial research, which I regard as largely research, is the foundation of a larger project entitled Whatever Happened to Sex in Scandinavia, which is an exhibition project and research project which I am working on together with the Danish critic and curator Lars Bang Larsen, good name, and that will be realized in 2007. The project came out of an interest, and my own interest, to revisit how modernism was defined in Scandinavia, primarily in Norway, and to and how that's presented today. And it also came out of a conjecture that the representations of sex in Scandinavia came out of a conscious campaign by the welfare state in the 1960s to generate Scandinavia as a sexually utopic space. But what my initial research led me to was that this conjecture was not delving enough into the history to reveal that sexual liberal policies endemic to Scandinavia in the 1960s and 1970s came out of a much longer tradition rooted through the historical formation of the welfare state by the Socialist Party at the beginning of the 20th century, in addition to an inquiry into sexual radicalism through revisions in psychoanalysis in the 1930s conducted in Scandinavia during that time. Men have landed on the moon, but to many, I am curious yellow, I am curious blue, will be the event of 1969. Such read the headlines of American newspapers around the Swedish director Vilgot Sherman's film that was seized by the US custom officials in 1968, followed by a highly visible trial regarding its obscenity charges. The film, primarily political in content, and containing scenes with full frontal nudity, was publicly billed as a film around pornography. When interviewed by journalists, the director Sherman claimed that it was the excessive male nudity that troubled the custom censors, adding that it was interesting to see that male nudity was somehow deemed more dangerous and shocking than female nudity that was so prevalent in films and advertising at the time. I Am Curious Yellow, released in Sweden in 1967, unfolds around Lena, a young actress employed by Sherman to play the role of an inquisitive radical student who engages in an active public inquiry as to the social, political, and sexual issues relevant to Swedes at the time. It is never clear at any particular point throughout the film whether the Lena we are seeing is from real life or the Lena in Sherman's film, a purposeful device used by the director to further complicate our reading. It's never clear at any particular point throughout the film whether the Lena we are seeing, yes, okay, to complicate our reading of the film as documentary or cast. Sexual encounters occur, but they represent a set of intimate relations that evolve around distrust, anger, envy, and betrayal. At the time of the U.S. release of the film, Vincent Canby, the New York Times film critic at the time, describes the scenes as, quote, explicit, honest, and so unaffectedly frank as to be non-pornographic, unquote. He continues, by acknowledging the existence of genitalia and their function in the act of love, the movie salvages the depiction of physical love from the scrap heap of exploitation, camp, and stag films. Obscenity as a vehicle of political manipulation was addressed by Herbert Marcuse in his essay on liberation, which had been published in 1969. Teaching at the University of California in San Diego, Marcuse proposed a critical analysis of society to emphasize that, quote, obscenity is a moral concept in the verbal arsenal of the establishment, which abuses the term by applying it not to the expressions of its own morality, but to those of another. Obscene is not the picture of a naked woman who exposes her pubic hair, but that of a fully clad general who exposes his medals rewarded in the war of aggression, unquote. Essay on Liberation has been Marcuse's follow-up to Eros and Civilization, which had been published in 1955 and which addressed through a revision of Freudian theory a possible juncture between the erotic and the political. The book eventually resonated with the concerns of the leftist student movement in the 1960s as it called for social reform and erotic liberation so close to their concerns. Through a reevaluation of Sigmund Freud's concept of sexuality, Marcuse revised Freud's claim that sexual repression was necessary for a civilization to survive. Taking issue with Freud's ahistorical reading of the human condition, Marcuse wrote that the opposition between society and sexuality was not eternal, as Freud maintained, rather it was historically and economically contingent. He conceded that in times of scarcity, basic sexual repression was required to maximize the productivity of workers. In these periods, workers must delay their own gratification for the sake of society as a whole, marking a period when the body is de-eroticized. Unlike Freud, Marcuse rejected the argument that repression was universally necessary. The excuse of scarcity used to justify institutionalized repression since its inception lost its force when man's knowledge and control over nature made possible the means for fulfilling human needs with minimum of toil. Given the surplus created by a post-industrial capitalism, Marcuse felt that one could unleash the libidinal instinct from its historical repression without fear of economic ruin. In this way, he argued for a wider experience of sexuality through the embrace of eros, in general within a polymorphous sensuality, fantasy, and the arts. Although regarded as the father of the New Left for his influence on intellectual discourse on popular culture and scholarly popular culture studies, inspiring mantras like make love, not war, Marcuse rejected this role in, for example, the hippie love movement and in his role in the hippie love movement. In 1966, in his preface to the reprinted Eros and Civilization, he wrote, quote, in the defense of life, the phrase has explosive meaning in the affluent society. It involves not only the protest against neo-colonial war and slaughter, the burning of draft cards at the risk of prison, the fight for civil rights, the fight for civil rights, but also the refusal to speak the dead language of affluence, to wear the clean clothes, to enjoy the gadgets of affluence, to adopt the education of affluence. The new boheme, the beatniks, the hipsters, the peace creeps, all these decadents now have become what decadence probably always was, poor refuge of defamed humanity, unquote. I Am Curious was precisely not that, not a free-for-all film about sexual liberation, but a film, moreover, about filmmaking, political inquiry, and a broader capitalist critique. As the central character, Lena, conducts endless interviews with citizens of Stockholm, asking if they believe whether they live in a classless society, she badgers members of the labor movement as to why their party is so damn conservative. She greets Swedish tourists returning from Franco's Spain while accosting them on their hypocritical actions in visiting a dictatorship and abandoning democratic ideals. Individuals such as Barry Rossett understood that it was the film's caustic political critique that caused it to be seized by US authorities on obscenity charges. As an anti-censorship crusader, Rosset was owner of Grove Press, the publisher of many books and the influential offbeat Evergreen Review. Having had two of his former publications censored, Lady Chatterley's Lover and Tropic of Cancer, Rosset was privy to how the US legal system used the label of pornography to ban materialism that was otherwise critical of democracy, capitalism, or America's role in the Vietnam War. Purchasing the rights for the film's distribution in the United States, he found ways to screen the film in independent cinema houses, its clandestine screenings only generating even wider interest. Eventually, the initial ban was overturned, accompanied by a court ruling stating that the film was, quote, not without redeeming social values, unquote. Vincent Canby once again reviewed the film and noted, I am curious yellow, having opened to long queues of largely middle-aged and ruly crowds, is a good serious movie about the society in transition, told in terms of recording devices, pads and pencils, posters, cinema, verite, interviews, tape recordings, and fiction film. It was this attempt that the movie was led straight from customs to the U.S. District Court, which, showing its usual extraordinary artistic sense, promptly labeled the movie dangerous for the same adult population that it is being softened by detergent commercials, unquote. An eventual Supreme Court ruling was reached in 1973 in the United States that, quote, made serious artistic, political, or scientific value the criteria for requirement for finding that something is not obscene, and a finding of some artistic, political, or scientific value does not preclude a finding that a work is obscene, unquote. The change in the opinion of, quote, the establishment in relation to erotic material, according to Marcuse, was merely a way to manipulate obscenity rules as a means to implement effective controls rather than fill out the restrictions. He writes, in this way, the gradual liberalization of sexuality provides an instinctual basis for the repressive and aggressive power of affluent society. Following the scandal, unquote, following the scandal around I Am Curious Yellow, US President Lyndon B. Johnson appointed a task force to report on the problem of pornography. The details of the first report of the first presidential commission on obscenity and pornography circulated in the fall of 1970. The majority of its committee members reached the opinion that pornography was harmless, perhaps even beneficial. As a result, the commission voted to recommend a repeal to all the laws intended to prohibit consenting adults from purchasing or consuming sexually explicit material. The commission added, quote, that sexually explicit materials serve to increase and to facilitate constructive communication about sexual matters within marriage, and that the most frequent purchaser of explicit sexual materials was a college-educated, married male in his 30s and 40s, above average socioeconomic status. This only reaffirmed Marcuse's belief that, quote, the consumer economy and the politics of corporate capitalism needed to create a second nature of man which tied him libidinally and aggressively to the commodity form. The need for possessing, consuming, handling, and constantly renewing gadgets, devices, instruments for using these wards, even at the danger of one's own destruction, unquote. In this sense, it countered his ideas that individuals should transform themselves, ends into themselves, rather than the means. In many ways, he foresaw the proliferation of the pornography industry and its products. Sherman, the director of I Am Curious Yellow, made clear that the film was his effort to dismantle the narrative form and to focus on the film as a vehicle of political inquiry in conveying the truth, but from what he claimed was, quote, as the left-wing angle, unquote. And once again, a New York Times interview, Sherman noted, I am sort of portraying from a Marxist point of view a society where people are using their jobs and even their personal life, their bodies, in order to use each other, in order to get ahead in society. I Am Curious Yellow opens with a documentary reel, one in which the Soviet poet Yevgeny Yevtushenko addresses a revolutionary student organization in Stockholm. This documentary fragment is fused with a scene from the audience, one in which the character Lena is sitting next to the director Sherman. An aspiring actress, Lena turns to Sherman and flirtatiously asks if he might consider casting her in a love scene. The director poses Lena's entire relationship to the film in this very scene, both as actress who relies on her appearance, at one point self-reflecting on her chubby figure and lagging breasts, and as a real person in the form of a political subject. In doing so, Sherman introduces the subject of a woman as part of the history of cinema as one of film's critical claims. He does so by exploring the parallel structure of the political and the sexual, accompanied by issues of sexual difference throughout the film, as he does with the real gauged against the staged. This dichotomy is parodically illustrated in Sherman's opening statements about his work, quote, "This film is one about Swedish socialism, about its two heads, the big self-satisfied one and the little shrunken one," unquote. And I'd like to show a clip from the film.
Дорогие друзья, мы очень благодарны вам за то, что вы сюда пришли.
Titta där borta. Ser du den där killen?
Ja.
Magnus. Han är på studentteatern. Han skulle passa till slaven.
Han?
Mm. Och så kan jag få en liten kärleksscen. Ja,
så. Mm. Den ska den vara.
En sån där liten snabbis.
Kan ni ordna en mikrofon?
Men nog är det jävligt att hon inte begriper politik. Men herregud, teaterelever.
Над бабьим яром памятников нет. Крутой обрыв, как...
Någon gång ska jag berätta för Lena om socialismens öde i Sverige. Nej, förresten, jag ska berätta för en om socialismens bägge huvuden i Sverige. Det stora, självbelåtna huvudet och det lilla, förkrympta.
Can cut the film. Okay. And I'd like to show a second fragment from the film which portrays Lena in her evolved role, and also the way that Sherman places the political up against the erotic or the sexual. So the second fragment, please.
Förhandlingar, medling, demonstrationer och strejk, sit-in-strejk, ligg-ner-strejk, omvänd strejk, hungerstrejk, sabotage, ekonomisk och social bojkott, skattevägran, civil ohörsamhet, förlamning av hela samhället.
Parallell regering, har du det då?
Ola, det är också med. Vem ska vi skicka det här till nu då?
Överbefälhavaren. De är ju inte kloka som inte undervisar om sånt här. Mm. Jag prövade med duschen igår.
Gjorde du det?
Mm.
Hur var det då?
Nej, det gick inget bra alls.
Höll du den rätt?
Ja, jag höll den som du sa, så här.
Det dammsugare då? Jag vet en tjej som alltid kör med dammsugare.
Nej, då tror jag mer på massageapparaten.
The portrayal of forthright nudity is used as a device in hijacking the film from its traditional approach in interjecting nudity as a charged and eroticized provocation. In the film's more candid love scenes, Lena lies next to Bjarne, caressing her flaccid lover. Sherman maintains this one among the main scenes that had led to its censoring. In his decision to cast the male in what had traditionally been the female role of a passive receiver, Sherman places the subject of sexual difference within a structure when the phallus is already privileged, returning to the psychoanalytic concept of disavowal to redefine it. The question of sexual difference is to recognize its phallic reference, how a woman is structured as the image around this reference, and how she thereby comes to represent the potential loss of difference which underpins the whole system. Lena does not succumb as a mere body, as sexuality frozen in spectacle, but and the object of a mere phallic desire. Can we have the next film?
Svårt att vara och hitta det, Lena.
Har du letat mycket?
Ja, mycket.
Vilken snygg bil du hade.
Tycker du det? Ja, bytt jobb. Mm. Jag slutar på Rudén så bytt jobb.
Vad gör du nu då?
Alltså det är bilar. Mm. Har du gjort här nere hela tiden?
Det här är trappstenen. Här gick de ut och in.
Can we shift to PowerPoint? Can you shift to PowerPoint? No. We're going back to PowerPoint. Yeah, okay. The way Sherman treats Lena in this film is perhaps foreseeing a later work of art by Linda Benglis, which was produced in 1954 as a poster. The image was intended as an outright attack of patriarchal hierarchies in the form of a notorious advertisement for the artist gallery show, commenting on the macho posturing of minimalist and post-minimalist artists. I Am Curious Yellow was released against an international understanding of Scandinavia as a constellation of countries practicing liberal sexual policy. American intellectuals saw Scandinavia in terms of its adept ability to balance the needs of community with those of the individual, immune to the Judeo-Christian concerns about the body. Nevertheless, this perception had a tendency to be exaggerated by those very same writers and intellectuals. In 1969, the chief foreign affairs correspondent for the New York Times, C.L. Sulzberger, published Foreign Affairs, Sex and Sense, an article that addressed Denmark's 1967 decision to abolish its censorship laws. The reversal of the law was adopted after the release of a comprehensive report that claimed a ban on censorship led to the decline of sex crimes. Sulzberger wrote, "There is nothing in the least bit either unwholesome or immoral about the Danes, who simply share with Benjamin Franklin that honesty is the best policy," adding, "The Danish experiment was admirable for its bold effort to sweep aside the shibboleths that have been confusing mankind for centuries." Unquote. Sulzberger's report, however, continued to provide extraneous information, adding that a bill that had been proposed and eventually overturned by the Socialist People's Party called for legal marriage between persons of the same sex, between brother and sister, or between one man and an unlimited amount of women. Further cited in his article were Denmark's mega families, groups of unrelated adults of both sexes and their children, of which 50 were known to exist at the time, were an accepted phenomenon of the contemporary scene. That was in his article. Perhaps exaggerated, Denmark was indeed the more liberal in its sexual policy than the other Nordic countries. Still in 1966, for example, Norway banned, and I excuse if I mispronounce this, Uten en Trud, a book that served a critique, served to critique sexual mores at the time. The story written by Jens Bjørnebo told of a 19-year-old Lillian who finds it incapable to reach orgasm with her boyfriend. She visits a sex specialist called Dr. Pettersen, who instructs her in exercises to help her achieve her goal. In 1967, Bjørnebo was convicted in the Norwegian Supreme Court for having written an immoral, obscene novel. This was the last book in Norway to have been indicted on such grounds. Despite differentiations between the countries, the overall stereotypical understanding of Scandinavia was, as a New York Times article in 1960 printed, one of sin, suicide, socialism, and smorgasbord. Stereotypes about the Scandinavian way of life were rooted in a more primary suspicion on the part of the United States in the proliferation of an economically healthy and expanding welfare state in the north of Europe. In 1960, President Eisenhower warned against the consequences of an expanded domestic welfare policy in the United States, denouncing those, quote, fairly friendly European countries, unquote, where socialism has brought about a sharp increase in suicides, twice our drunkenness, and a lack of moderation discernible on all sides, unquote. Articles accusing Scandinavia as a haven of sin were marked by birth control, abortion, and promiscuity reigns throughout the United States. This was in the same article from 1960. The manifest of social democracy, the architect of which was the welfare state, was particularly threatening to America as a market economy. And this is what Bobbio writes in Liberalism and Democracy, what was evolving was a distancing between a democracy rooted in direct participation, increased equality in the distribution of economic power, versus another constructed as a representative democracy rooted in participation of political power through elected representatives. At the time I Am Curious Yellow was seized by the US Customs, Scandinavia was experiencing a period of unprecedented prosperity with an implementation of an active labor policy in the 1960s designed to maintain full employment in addition to a strong mobilization of sentiment against the referendum votes for EC and EU membership. More problematic for American authorities was not so much the frontal nudity in Sherman's films, but the cameo appearance perhaps of Olof Palme, a politician who became leader of a generation of radical Swedish social democrats, a party that stood politically much further to the left than their predecessors. A controversial political figure on the international scene, Palme was outspoken on many issues, with his criticism of the United States for the Vietnam War, vocal opposition to the Soviets' crushing of the Prague Spring, campaigning against nuclear weapons proliferation, criticism toward the Franco regime in Spain, opposition to apartheid and support for economic sanctions against South Africa, his support both political and financial for the African National Congress and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, meeting with Fidel Castro of Cuba, all this ensured that Palme had much international opposition. Certainly, public distribution of his persona that represented radical economic democratic goals of the Social Democrats after 1968, as they were called, and his ideas around the breakdown of organized social capital. Can we have the next film fragment, please?
Starka drag av ett gammalt klassamhälle. Vi har, som jag tror någon har sagt, ett inkomstklassamhälle. Och man kan precis se vilka orsaker det är. Man har lägre inkomster på landsbygden än i tätorter och i stora städer. Man har lägre inkomst om man är kvinna och man är man. Man har lägre inkomst om man är äldre än om man är yngre. Utbildningen är ju en fantastisk inkomstklassindelare fortfarande. Den som har gått igenom en spärrad linje på en högskola kanske har 6-7 gånger större inkomster än den som har folkskola fått ett låglönejobb på landsbygden.
Kom ut istället, hör du. Det går in i ljudet om du smäller där, så.
Som jag upplever ganska starkt i det svenska samhället. Det är den man har reagerat mot från början, va? Därför så lever man...
Var kommer du från för miljö själv?
Jag kommer ju från påtagligt borgerlig miljö. Man läser sig till en del, man ser en del. Och så plötsligt så börjar det hela foga sig samman till ett mönster. Och det skedde någon gång mellan jag var 15 och 20. När jag såg det amerikanska samhället, kan du säga.
Åkte du runt i Amerika? Vilket år var det här ungefär?
47, jag lyfta. Jaha. 34 stater, 3 månader utan pengar.
Apparent liberal sexual policy in the 1960s in Scandinavia was not, as in the United States, the result of some 60s liberation movement, but more substantively rooted in radical social reform structures, healthcare, equality between the sexes, to reflect policy initiatives and social engineering intended to shape what Marcuse aspired to as a social wealth for shaping man's world in accordance with life instincts. The motivations for social welfare states policies in the form of altruism, self-insurance against individual economic risk, and solidarity as a common responsibility or reciprocal obligation seem very much in setting out the preconditions for the emergence of a truly human city-state and nation through the establishment of society that protects, perpetuates, and enlarges life. And that's written by Marcuse. But sex reform in Scandinavia saw its achievements well before the establishment of the welfare state. Sex reform evolved around civil, political, and social rights, closely linked with the political agenda of the Socialist Party, largely promoted by women activists by the women's activist movement from 1890 to 1920, specifically within Norway. This period marked a remarkable period of achievement for women's political rights as part of the agenda in Norway's struggle for national independence and a sovereign state. In 1896, the Norwegian Women's Public Health Association was formed, which eventually evolved into the National Council of Norwegian Women in 1904. Socialist women, however, formed an umbrella organization in 1901 called the Women's Federation of the Labour Party. In Norway, Kati Anker Møller was at the forefront of the women's activist movements, calling for emancipation of motherhood in the form of assistance for single mothers, for welfare benefits for mothers, and in the emphasis on motherhood as being voluntary. By 1910, the social rights of Norwegian women stood out in an international perspective. Sweden, for example, was the last to introduce political rights to men and women. Norwegian publications and newspapers allowed for women at this time, in the early part of the 20th century, allowed for women to enter into positions of journalists by 1910, and individuals such as Elise Ottesen began to write in Labour's Nytid, New Times, an internationalist newspaper circulating out of Trondheim. New Times focused most on its editorial space, on poor housing conditions of the working class, and on the need for the provision of public housing to be financed by the public commune. The paper's editorial policy was committed toward the improvement of women's conditions, including supporting improvements in the 1909 National Health Insurance Program, aimed to benefit working class mothers, and in the improvement in the competence of midwives. The paper also allocated space to the debate around venereal disease, working around the Norwegian law issued in 1894, that banned the dissemination of information about contraceptives. Nytid printed information about the availability of condoms on the ads of mail order firms that sold rubber products. Articles about venereal disease were accompanied by others around prostitution, with claims that prostitution was linked to a neo-farious capitalist system in which members of the bourgeoisie bought the bodies of poor women like all else they desired with earnings from the cheap labor they exploited. That was a quote from an article. Overall, Nytid and its community of writers promoted an editorial policy through a political agenda of socialism as a political model that proposed a future, quote, between men and women that enabled them to choose to live together in a partnership based on mutual love and equality, unquote, as written in an article from 1911. Norway's Socialist Party backed an ambitious sex reform program and a proliferation of that program through such important speakers as Kati Møller, who in 1910 gave a well-publicized speech in Stavanger promoting sex education in schools and urging Norwegian women to learn about their reproductive organs and not to regard this part of their makeup as natural and not shameful. At the time, key figures such as Kata Dolstrom and Henrik Bergegren, through their association with the Norwegian Youth Socialists, presented their views around sex mores in a publicized speech in Stockholm in 1910 entitled Kärlek utan barn, Love Without Babies, that spoke about their benefits to the working class of limiting their families through the use of contraception. Still later, in 1926, Elise Ottesen produced a 61-page booklet entitled Uvälkomna barn, Unwanted Babies, an inexpensive paperback with a cover illustrated by Katie Kollwitz, a drawing of a working class mother and child on the cover. This book served as the only literature made available at the time on the subject of reproduction and contraceptive practice. Its purpose, however, was not only intended for family planning, but as a sex education tool in preserving the pleasure of sex relations for both wife and husband. The recognition of sexual difference as acknowledged and privileged in the political understanding were at the forefront of Ottesen and Müller's campaigns. Their objective to change fundamental forms of inequality and subordination which resulted in the construction of gender in social policies, particularly once again in the Norwegian policy matrix. These socio-political achievements by the women's movement of the earlier part of the 19th century were, however, challenged with the introduction of psychoanalysis, largely criticized by those very same feminists in the 1930s as a predominantly patriarchal institution that introduced the concept of the unconscious as one fossilizing within a specific domain. Without taking into consideration the unconscious as historically contingent, psychoanalysis neglected the very importance of the unconscious in bringing into play the role of fantasy and images of sexual difference. The psychoanalyst and revisionary psychoanalyst, Otto Fenichel, established himself in Oslo in 1930s, and he recognized at this time the tendency for psychoanalysts to be reductivist and for its need to integrate political analysis. In his Drive to Amass Wealth, printed in 1934, Fenichel writes, "The study of modifications of instinct is in no way an essential bagatelle, but it is one of the greatest importance theoretically as well as practically. The statement that the production and dissemination of ideology of society must be understood from the actual economic conditions of this society, the superstructure of which is ideology. That further they are to be understood from the fact that this superstructure, by means of the actions of human beings, reacts back again upon the foundation, the economic conditions modifying them. These statements are correct but general. They become more specific when we succeed in comprehending scientifically the details of the mechanisms of these transformations, and only psychoanalysis is able to help us in that." Unquote. Fenichel understood the psychic forces of the ideological process while avoiding the weaknesses of sociological and psychological reductivism. In the sociologist's dismissing of the psychic investments of social life as mere bagatelle, and the psychoanalyst's falling into an equivalent trap which makes the psychic and the primary determining factor in the social mechanisms which serve to drive, these arguments were raised by Jacqueline Rose in her Sexuality and the Field of Vision. And she was the one to note that Fenichel's argument foreshadows Juliet Mitchell's later claim in Psychoanalysis and Feminism, printed in 1974. In this, Juliet Mitchell writes, "The way we live as ideas, the necessary laws of human society, is not so much conscious as unconscious. The particular task of psychoanalysis is to decipher how we acquire our heritage of the ideas and laws of human society within the unconscious mind. Or, to put it another way, the unconscious mind is the way we acquire these laws. Where Marxist theory explains the historical and economic situation, psychoanalysis, in conjunction with the notions of ideology already gained by the dialectical materialism, is the way into understanding ideology and sexuality. According to Rose, the feminist move was to add sexuality to the historically established links between psychoanalysis and the understanding of how ideology works. It was in this context that sexual difference was analyzed as one of the most fundamental, if not the most fundamental, of human laws. This was the acknowledgement that sexual difference should be acknowledged in the fullest range of its effects and then privileged in political understanding and debate. Mitchell's debate, then, as elaborated by Rose, inserts the question of femininity back into a project which, as long ago as the 1930s, had seen psychoanalysis as the only means of explaining the exact mechanisms whereby the ideological processes are transformed via individual subjects into human actions and beliefs. Fennekel, working in Oslo in the 1930s, invited Wilhelm Reich to join the community of radical thinkers around psychoanalysis. Reich, among the first to seriously attempt to develop a critical social theory implicit in Freud, wrote in his Einbruch and Sexual Moral from 1931 that psychoanalysis was oriented on the relation between the social and instinctual structures. He emphasized the extent to which sexual repression is enforced by the interests of domination and exploitation, and the extent to which these interests are turned and reinforced and reproduced by sexual repression. As Herbert Marcuse, Reich became eventually a central figure for the radical student movements, primarily in Paris in the 1960s, when Reichian symbols depicting human conflicts produced a societal repression of sexuality were crudely painted on the walls of the Sorbonne. Reich urged that any real change in society could be achieved through sexual education and sexual freedom through his research, psychotherapy, and social psychology. Elisa Ottesen, who was introduced to Reich in 1930 when he presented the sexual misery of the working class in Vienna, identified with his citing of the major causes as housing, criminal abortion law, and poor sex education, but she did not agree with his interests of applications of communist theory in analyzing sexuality. Reich's early social psychological writing, particularly Mass Psychology of Fascism, broke new ground in the study of the relations of the social structure to the individual character and in some ways foreshadowed thinkers as Marcuse. Reich's more radical thinking around the sexual struggle occurred while he lived in Norway from 1934 through 1939. Having been expelled from the International Psychoanalytic Association and being engulfed by fascism in Europe, Reich came to Oslo under the invitation of Otto Fennekel at the Institute of Psychology. It was here that Reich pursued his experiments in orgastic potency as a criterion of mental health, a point that, while revisiting Freudian theory, was very much unacceptable to Freud. Reich believed that the orgasm theory had important implications for the psychotherapeutic and political activities. Hence, he disagreed with Freud's view that the humanitarian ideas of socialism were humanly untenable. Befriending Oslo's leading intellectuals as Sternesen and the architect Arne Cosmo, Reich published a journal throughout the period of his stay in the country. He undertook experiments designed to measure and demonstrate the physical reality of the sexual energy whose suppression played such a large part in the personal and social misery of mankind. At first, he measured the electrical potential of the skin during sexual excitation and fantasy. Later, he debunked his own proposal that sexual energy was something electrical and mechanical, understanding that it had to be alive and pulsating. Hence, he began to seek out the origins of life around the discovery of physical energy called orgon that permeated the atmosphere and all living matter. The experiments were designed to release the living energy bound up in inanimate matter to transform non-living matter into living material. The results were published in, in the book Bion Experiments on the Organ of Life from 1938 in Oslo, where he concluded on vegetotherapy, a procedure aimed at eliminating the armor of stiffness in all parts of the body, which involved massage and breathing exercises in a kind of chiropractic self-realization theory. Eventually, Reich was maligned by the Norwegian press, and the increasing public antagonisms toward his work prompted him to leave for the United States in 1938. During his stay, however, he succeeded to publish the classic entitled Sexual Revolution. The publication addressed the need to relieve sexual repression as, quote, if one represses one's own sexuality, one develops all kinds of moralistic and aesthetic defenses. When patients regain contact with their sexual needs, these neurotic differentiations disappear. According to Marcuse, Reich's notion of sexual repression remains undifferentiated. By neglecting the historical dynamic of sex instincts and of their fusion with destructive impulses. Consequently, sexual liberation becomes for Reich a panacea for individual and social ills, as progress and freedom appears as mere release of sexuality. In this sense, Marcuse faults Reich with a sweeping primitivism that comes to dominate his later research. And these are drawings for the Organon, which is the organ accumulator, which he developed later in the United States. And there are many rumors in Norway as to the fact that these experiments measuring the electrical skin components actually took part in an Arna Cosmo villa called the Stjernesund Villa that had been built for Stjernesund in Oslo. Marcuse was opposed to Reich's theories around unbound genital energy and set out in his own revision of Freud's concept of sexuality to prolong the inquiry into a possible juncture between the erotic and political dimensions without being co-opted by the establishment. In his 1966 preface printed in the reissued Eros and Civilization, Marcuse writes, quote, affluent society has already foreseen that it must adopt a new language to prevent dissonance. It therefore organizes the desire for beauty and the hunger for community, the renewal of the contact with nature, the enrichment of the mind, and honor for creation for its own sake. The false ring of such proclamations is indicative of the fact that within the established system, these aspirations are translated into administered cultural activities sponsored by the government and the big corporations, an extension of their executive arm into the soul of the masses, unquote. Understanding that a system is increasingly co-opted by a liberal language, Marcuse warns against the system of societal institutions and relations, laws and values, which transmit and enforce the required modification of the instincts. He refers to the additional restrictive controls arising from the specific instructions of domination as surplus repression, among which are the perpetuation of the monogamic patriarchal family or by the hierarchical division of labor, or by the public control over the individual's private existence. He uses the distinction in aesthetic ideas and those of the sexual instinct to make the argument explaining that, quote, the pleasure of smell and taste is much more of a bodily, physical one, more akin to sexual pleasure than is the more sublime pleasure aroused by the sound and the least bodily of all pleasures, the sight of something beautiful. Smell and taste, for example, relate individuals immediately without the conventionalized forms of consciousness, morality, aesthetics. Such immediacy is incompatible with the effectiveness of organized domination, with a society which tends, quote, to isolate people, to put distance between them, and to prevent spontaneous relationships and the natural animal-like expressions of such relations. The pleasures of proximity senses plays on the erotogenic zones of body and does so only for the sake of pleasure. Their unrepressed development would eroticize the organism to such an extent that it would counteract the desexualization of the organism required by its social utilization as an instrument of labor, unquote. The result is a repressive organization of sexuality that alters the very nature of sexuality from an autonomous principle governing the entire organism into a specialized temporary function into a means for the end. In her Sexuality in the Field of Vision, Jacqueline Rose writes that film's power as an ideological apparatus rests on the mechanisms of identification and sexual fantasy, which we all seem to participate in, but which, outside of cinema, are, for the most part, only ever admitted on the couch. The cinematic apparatus of I Am Curious Yellow, as a film around the imaginary, but within the debates of realism, reveals the construction of reality to defy the notion of posing. In doing so, it is not a film that is shrouded in an elusive narrative, but relates the unconscious in the unconscious way we live our lives and how ideological processes transform our lives. Shortly after I Am Curious Yellow was released, the Swedish film Language of Love, and once again in Swedish, if I bastardize this, is Harlekenspråk, arrived in the United States only to be similarly seized by the US Customs in 1969. There was a difference in the treatment of Sherman's film and this of Tony Vickman's film. As a straightforward sex education film, Language of Love included a panel of frank experts speaking about sex with the aid of volunteers who acted as real-time diagrams and performative examples of the experts' observations. The panel of experts, a Swedish gynecologist, a Swedish psychologist educator, and Inge and Sten Hegelar, two quite well-known Danish psychologists, who were also authors, speak about sexual anxieties and misconceptions, petting, masturbation, contraceptives, the organs in an instructional manual format. Volunteers cooperate via hidden cameras to demonstrate the experts' instructions. This film is accompanied by music from ABBA. This film had been the film classic that in the film Taxi Driver from 1976, Travis Bickle, Robert De Niro, takes Sybil Shepherd to see. In its didactic format, it did not provide neither the salacious quality of what evolved as its competitors in the form of Deep Throat or the slew of Swedish sexploitation films that would follow throughout the 1970s. I should say, add that Inge and Sten Hegelar were known for a kind of a book called ABZ to Love, quite popular in the 60s, initially censored in the early 60s in Denmark. And they also had a popular column on sex in Dagbladet in Norway and in other places. But I want to show a fragment from this film so you can see how problematic it was. And can we forward to the next clip as well? And this clip is categorized as pretentious male, and it's a woman asking her husband to read a book. Can you have the second clip? We'll go on.
Du kan väl läsa den här boken. Det är så kloka och förståndiga människor som har skrivit den.
Vad fan ska jag läsa såna här böcker för? Jag vet inte vad jag gör. Hör du, det är ingen som har klagat förut.
According to Marcuse, civilization is continuously threatened by an instinctual diffusion in which the death instincts strive to gain ascendancy over the life instincts. And Inge Iversen, who was one of the directors of this film, Language of Love, was the same director who was involved in the explicit sex education, who was involved in the film Language of Love. He was also the person who helped change the regulation of the Swedish Board of Censors. He later produced the film Thriller, A Cruel Picture, with the famous centerfold star Christina Lindberg. Oddly enough, it succeeded to be the first film to be censored in Sweden. The film takes on, as its point of departure, a young girl who takes revenge against a childhood of molestation. The mix of heavy violence and sex within this film is what made the film too provocative for the public and prompted censors to ban the film in Sweden. So I'd just like to conclude on the next question, whatever happened to sex in Scandinavia? In 1973, Lyotard writes in La Cinema and Theory, must the victim be on stage for a jouissance to be intense? His reference is the woman captured in what he refers to as Swedish posering. Swedish posering, according to him, is in which the erotic subject is fixed and immobile, posed, women as the object of the spectator's gaze, who thus enjoys bodies at a distance. He notes that, quote, presently there exists in Sweden an institution called posering, a name derived from the pose solicited by the portrait photographers. Young girls rent their services to these special houses, services which consist of assuming clothes or unclothing, the poses desired by the client. It is against house rules, which are not the houses of prostitution, for the clients to touch the models in any way. It must be seen how the paradox is distributed in this case. The immobilization seems to touch only the erotic object, while the subject is found overtaken by liveliest agitation, unquote. And this is actually Lillian Müller, who was quite a well-known Norwegian centerfold, who was quite popular in the 1970s in Penthouse and Playboy. Thank you.
Getting slightly behind with the time, so we'll try and keep this question period slightly shorter possible so we can get on to Eric's and keep within about half an hour of our original schedule. Sex in Scandinavia in the 1960s and 70s. Questions thereon? This is why I say don't be shy. There's one there, Pablo.
You saw an image of the film WR. You saw an image of WR. Of Machiavelli.
Yeah, I was short of time, but that's to get into that.
I don't know much about him, but as far as I know, he comes from a different, he's Yugoslavian, right? He's from Yugoslavia, right?
Yeah, the reason I noted the WR, there was a film that I had not spoken about. It was a film that came out in the early 70s by the Black Wave Yugoslavian film director Dušan Makavejev called W.R. Mysteries of the Organism, where he takes the sort of hallucinatory story of Wilhelm Reich and how he got involved in very obscure experimentation around the organ accumulator in the United States and was subsequently arrested and died in prison, and then sort of the demise of the American capitalist system next to another story, which is a narrative about a woman who tries to revive a very stoic ice skater. So these kinds of three stories, he's actually bringing together the aftermath of sexual radicalism of the 60s together with the market economy that he felt it was a critique of that, together with what was happening at Yugoslavia at the time.
Yeah, because I thought that, I don't know much about him, but I mean, I think that in all his films, humor is a very important element. And I don't know, I thought that was something that you were going to bring up when bring his case in, because in the first films it wasn't. I mean, so but I didn't know if that was going to be the point. But
well, it was as if, I mean, what started happening, if you look at a lot of the newspaper articles that were coming out after I Am Curious Yellow, I Am Curious Blue, there began to be a slew of films that were coming in, and again to the United States, that were less and less caustic for the censors. Like, they finally said, okay, we can see everything now and nothing is the problem. And when the W.R. Organisms of Mysteries of the Organisms was released, there was a headline, I think, that read, what else can there be to critique the American system? And it was about humor being the element inserted into something that is seemingly erotic.
Sorry, Madeline.
Hi, Paul Martin. My question is about Marcuse, which you sort of return to again and again. You mentioned Eros and Civilization and how this is a critique of Freud's sort of lack of a historically informed understanding of sexual life, its historical contingency, I think you spoke about. Do you think there's a contradiction between that and what he's kind of saying about liberated life, you know, kind of emancipated life? Because is there a danger of that being a new kind of naturalism or something? And if it is, if the answer to that is yes, then I wonder if that has implications for, you know, how we go back to these kind of films, given what's happened in the pornography industry within the even in the last, you know, 20, 30 years. That's two sort of related questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think he even had to reflect back on his writings later in the early 1970s to kind of say, okay, I sort of abandoned half of the things that I said in that period of time. And I think there is a point that I think that in my paper where I say that he rejected very much being that father of naturalism and proponent of sexual liberation he was not proposing that everyone should just go out there and start fucking. You know, I mean, he was really proposing another kind of phenomenon. But I think that what happens is that these films that were seemingly erotic in the 1960s that were pursuing really how do you go about making a political film such as Godard, and how do you go about it without completely abandoning one humor, irony, and also the issue of human liberation sexually, where there were all these attempts, and some of them were obviously a combination of the documentary together with a kind of narrative story. And slowly that gets, I mean, Marcuse begins to write quite a bit about how the system around the issues of the erotic and the juncture of the erotic and the political begin to be co-opted by the establishment itself. And then steadily you see other kinds of films that are coming into distribution in the early part of the 70s. I think it's at that period of time he sort of backtracks on his thoughts set out in Eros and Civilization. I don't know if that answers your question.
Do we have another question? If not, we will move on to the next speaker. Thank you, Marta.
Thanks.